The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're over in Oprah's digital magazine, End of Summer Scaries, You're Not Alone. This article is in the wellness section, and it's by Jane Burnett. Why does it feel like the sun is already setting on the best season? It's a simple and seemingly harmless question. Can you believe summer is almost over? But come August, it can spark major angst. Your high hopes at the beginning of the season, weekends on the sparkling shoreline, picnics in the park, a concert or music fest or two, didn't all come true. You may also have felt the pressure to stay social, vacation to the max, and somehow relax. And now, the last days are slipping through your fingers. According to Ohio-based clinical psychologist Sarah Kane Spanagel, PhD, the end of the season can bring feelings of loss. Letting go of some of the liberty that comes with the summer can be hard. Then there are the real, natural changes with levels of light that happen seasonally and that can really impact us. We take a little bit of a hit when those things happen. Read on for 3 tips to help you make the most of summer days. Number 1. Try this cognitive trick. Here's a trick to try next year. At the beginning of summer, or each season, Spanagel recommends making a list of activities you must do, ones you really enjoy doing, and ones you can skip. The idea is having a sense of agency, and the perspective is that not everything is an actual must, she explains. Revisit the list as the summer goes on. Add to it and be flexible. A helpful exercise would be something that was a must didn't happen and the sky didn't fall, did it? This assures you that it's okay to reprioritize yourself over a perceived must. If your scaries stem from feeling that you've turned down too many invitations, she recommends this handy tweak in thinking. You might be saying no to obligations, but what are you saying yes to, she says. So a reframe, I didn't make it to that, but I said yes to sitting on my patio by myself. Allow yourself to feel good about spending time alone when you need to. Think getting lost in an amazing book, taking a solo walk in nature, or whipping up a meal you love. That reframe can be a good enough cognitive switch to keep your mood where it should be and keep your guilt or FOMO down. It's a quick cognitive tactic that can make you feel okay with your decisions. Number 2. Redefine summer fun. Lose the bells and whistles. There was a time when the neighbor's parents let us all have fights in our backyard with cans of shaving cream for Labor Day. It got everywhere, says Amy Wilson, a New York-based author and co-host of the podcast What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood. That, to me, was like a month on the French Riviera in terms of awesome summer memories. We think we have to over-deliver for our families, but the things you and the kids will remember will surprise you with how mundane they are. So while you may not have accomplished everything on your list, it's still possible to do something fun with the time you have, whether or not there are kids involved. Try making s'mores over a fire pit in your backyard. Take a homemade picnic to a local outdoor concert, or drive out of town. Throw down a blanket and stargaze to your heart's content. Number 3. Drop the comparison game. It can be soul-crushing to scroll through pics of people's over-the-top vacations, complete with the twinkling blue waters off Saint-Tropez, or a casual sunrise hike to Machu Picchu. But remember that posts are highlight reels, snapshots in time without the full context. Hello, that's the point of social media. Here's where the potential for harmful comparisons comes in. There's a little bit of looking at others like, you're going on that trip, why would you ever be sad? Says Spanagel. But it's all relative. You have no real concept of their change in routine, their stressors, how they feel with the transition, or what the summer might be for them. It's worth keeping an eye on your end-of-summer scaries and how much they impact you. Spanagel notes that if you're feeling dread most of the time, or the feelings are especially intense, or you've felt this way for longer than a few days, you should seek clinical help to rule out SAD. But for most of us, it's a passing phase. If you're managing a crowded calendar and worrying that you've missed out on your greatest summer yet, remember to cut yourself some slack. Being intentional about your plans and leaning into simplicity are key. This article is in Wholeness and Lifestyle. What's the difference between jealousy and envy? These two emotions have very different meanings, and surprisingly, they both have benefits. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Wanting what you can't have is a tale as old as time. But nowadays, people often use the words envy and jealousy interchangeably, even when they refer to different, though equally uncomfortable, emotions. Brené Brown once nearly broke them down in an interview with Oprah. Envy is when we want something that someone else has. Jealousy is when we're afraid of losing something we already have to someone else. At a basic level, jealousy can be defined as feelings of anger or bitterness that a person is trying to take someone or something from you. It's the server who's a little too friendly with your date, or the newbie at work with the secretly sharp elbows who's encroaching on your territory. Envy, on the other hand, involves feelings of longing about what someone else already has. Think your old college roommate whose house is a little too picture-perfect on Instagram, or that colleague who has a knack for charming absolutely everyone they meet, your bosses included. According to Abigail Lev, therapist at Bay Area CBT Center, that yearning feeling of envy is often mixed with the belief or experience that you can't have something, adding that most of the time it's closely linked with shame. There's some core belief that something is wrong with you and that you're not good enough for what you desire, she explains. As with all tough emotions, it can be tricky to understand how they actually serve you, especially in the heat of the moment. Here's what the experts say about how they differ, plus when to listen to those feelings and when to tune them out. Envy, a not-so-deadly sin? A 2020 study in the academic journal Frontiers in Psychology found that a higher social standing, in other words, admiration from others, is one of the most common things to be envious of. They also outline two kinds of envy. The type where you want what someone else has, known as benign envy, and the kind where you want what someone else has and you also don't want them to have it, known as malicious envy. Malicious envy can be destructive, as it leads to resentment, frustration, and even hostility. On the other hand, benign envy can actually be helpful. Studies show it increases personal drive and motivation to improve performance. Instead of shaming yourself for feeling either form of envy, Lev says to ask yourself why you're feeling it. If you're envious of a person's job, for example, ask yourself what about it makes you feel that way. Is it the work itself? The relationship that person has with their boss? The creative freedom they have? It's important to delve as deeply as possible, because at its core, envy tells you what's important to you, what you value, and what you really need. Taming the Green-Eyed Monster. Jealousy often crops up in the context of a romantic relationship. According to several studies, there's even a difference in how jealousy manifests itself between the sexes. Men appear more likely to be jealous of sexual infidelity, while women are more likely to feel jealous over emotional infidelity. Research also shows that people with low self-esteem or insecurity are much more likely to feel jealous. But even if you're very secure, if you have a partner that's not a safe partner, you'll still feel jealous sometimes, says Lev. That might be a cue that your boundaries or your needs for safety, connect, and respect are not being fulfilled. Jealousy is undoubtedly a painful emotion that can damage relationships, but it can also teach you what to appreciate, a reminder that you don't want to lose whatever it is you are jealous over. While jealousy and envy aren't necessarily fun to feel, you can also learn from them. All emotions are barometers, Lev says. They're a guide. They give you information about your needs, whether they're being met or not met. We're on our word of the week. Gray rocking. Is this why you clam up at every family reunion? This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Gray rocking. No, this isn't some reference to boomers seeing dead in company. It's a lot quieter and less colorful. Gray rocking is a behavior that's used when faced with a challenging person, like a narcissist or an abuser. Rather than responding as they normally would, the person experiencing the trauma becomes a gray rock. In other words, they make themselves less emotional, reactive, and vulnerable. In turn, the narcissist or abuser becomes less interested in their subject. Think, in a morbid example, how prey might play dead in the face of a predator. A lot of people do this automatically, explains Christina Rasmussen, a grief educator and author of Invisible Loss. Even if they're just a little triggered, they mute themselves, responding in quick sentences, not sharing feelings, not being themselves. It's also more common than you'd think. Rasmussen says, we even do it in places like the office. Have you ever sent an email instead of calling your nightmarish colleague or walking over to their desk? That's a form of gray rocking because of the distance it creates. Employed like that in small doses, gray rocking can be a useful tool. It's a helpful piece of protection against narcissists you have quick interactions with, like when your racist uncle is on his latest soapbox at the family reunion. It may be harmless to engage in this behavior sporadically, and it's not inherently bad to use gray rocking as a safeguard, especially for those in abusive situations. But according to Rasmussen, you want to avoid autopiloting on this method. This is not a long-term solution. It's a quick escape method, she says. If it becomes automatic, then you lose your original, authentic self. Take time to remind yourself of who you really are. Spending time with someone who knows the real you, or doing something you've always loved. Trauma-busting homework that's actually fun. This next article is in Wellness. What menopause does to your bones and what you can do starting today. The supplements, exercises, and tests that will keep you strong and fracture-free from here on out. This article is by Rosie Hopegood. In the first 5 years after menopause, women lose, on average, 10% of their bone density. The primary reason is that our estrogen levels drop. And just as the hormone is critical to sexual, reproductive, heart, and brain health, it's essential to maintaining a strong skeleton. 10% might not sound like a lot, but the consequences are serious. Bones are a living, growing tissue that is constantly evolving. Before menopause, we're building them and we're breaking them down. It's a nice, even sort of teeter-totter, says Christy Tuff Desapri. And that's spelled D-E-S-A-P-R-I, M-D, founding physician and director of Bone and Body Women's Health in Illinois. She explains that much of our bone is built up in our teens and 20s, with density peaking by age 30 and nosediving post-menopause. Bones are broken down by a process called resorption, in which special cells use acid to dissolve the mineral structure. When bones are broken down faster than they can be rebuilt, you can develop osteoporosis, a condition that affects millions of Americans. Worldwide is one fracture every 3 seconds. Tough to Sapri notes, hip fractures are particularly dangerous. A recent study showed that among people over 65, less than a third of men and half of women were alive 5 years after suffering from this debilitating injury. Picture healthy bones as having a honeycomb structure, full of small holes. For those with osteoporosis, those holes become bigger, and the bone becomes more porous, making it more prone to fractures and breaks. Most people think osteoporosis is for women in their 70s, 80s, or 90s. But it isn't, says Tuff to Sapri. Women are shocked to believe that they have done their exercise their whole life. They've had their calcium and vitamin D, yet they have it. If you're starting to feel frail just reading this, buck up. There's a lot you can do to increase your bone health at any age, whether you've been diagnosed with osteoporosis or not. Number one, get a bone density scan ASAP. The Bone Health and Osteoporosis Foundation recommends that women start having these scans, known as DXAs, at age 65, age 70 for men. For people at risk of fractures, the recommended age drops to 50. See the next paragraph for signs. Medicare generally covers these scans every other year from 65 on, but for many women the damage is already done, says Tuff to Sapri. In my practice, everyone gets a DXA scan as young as 40, she says. 65 is way too late when you know that 50% of women have osteoporosis at the time of their scan. That's right. There are often no symptoms before your first fracture, which is why it's known as a silent disease. A scan might also indicate osteopenia, meaning your bone density is lower than it should be, but you don't yet meet the criteria for full-blown osteoporosis. There are certain osteoporosis risk factors that signal you may need a DXA sooner rather than later. These include early menopause, having a fracture from a recent fall or accident, a family history of osteoporosis, and the use of certain prescription medication, particularly certain steroids. There are also risk factors within your control. Smoking almost doubles your risk of having a hip fracture, while having a BMI below 19 is also a significant risk factor. And surprise, surprise, excessive alcohol consumption, defined as more than 2 units a day, also increases your likelihood of breaking a bone, as well as making you more likely to fall. Alcohol inhibits absorption of calcium. Long-term consumption is linked with decreased bone density and an increased risk of osteoporosis. According to Tuff to Sapri, a DXA measures quality and the quantity of bone in pretty much every bone in our body. It's a straightforward scan that takes minutes, and you can remain fully dressed. Oftentimes, the test is repeated every 1 to 2 years, depending on what your doctor deems necessary. Number two, remember that HRT is your friend. Estrogen plays a key role in skeletal health because it slows the breaking down of old bone and stimulates the activity of cells that make new bone, known as osteoblasts. So it should come as no surprise that hormone replacement therapy, HRT, which restores estrogen levels, is often a first port of call for protecting bone health. In fact, it's an FDA-approved treatment for the prevention of osteoporosis, says Tuff to Sapri. And if you already have osteoporosis, the estrogen from HRT can help to strengthen your bones and make breaks less likely. It's still vital to get tested regularly, though, since women can still lose bone density while on the therapy. Number three, HIIT the gym. Just as exercise improves muscle strength, it can fortify your bones. But not all workouts are equal. To stimulate bone formation, higher impact or repetitive resistant load exercises are best, explains Tuff to Sapri. Think lifting heavier weights or putting more impactful forces on your bones. The benefits stem from the stress these types of exercise place on your bones, which in turn encourages them to grow stronger. Load-bearing exercises like weightlifting or body weight exercises like squats and push-ups are great because every time you lift something heavy, muscle contractions tug on your bones. Meanwhile, high-impact exercise, think running, aerobics, or high-intensity interval training, HIIT, is beneficial because of the repeated stress of impact. Every time your feet hit the ground, your bones get a boost. Number 4. Eat calcium, vitamin D, and more calcium. Think of bones as looking like a loofah with a lattice structure made up of calcium hydroxyapatite, says Tuft Sapri. We need calcium to keep remodeling them. Post-menopause, she recommends aiming for 1,200 milligrams a day from both dairy, milk, yogurt, mozzarella, and Swiss cheese are a few easy options, and non-dairy sources, spinach, broccoli, figs, fortified orange juice, tofu, and sardines are all excellent. Top off real foods with supplements as needed. If you have osteoporosis, she notes, you should talk to your doctor about possible higher calcium needs. The International Osteoporosis Foundation has a calcium calculator to help you figure out if you're getting enough and references some surprisingly high calcium foods. White beans, broccoli, or seaweed, anyone? Tuff to Sapri also recommends a daily vitamin D supplement for people under 70. The dose is 600 IU a day. For over 70, it's 800 IU. Vitamin D increases the amount of calcium absorbed from food and is notoriously hard to get enough of from diet alone. But she warns, even at adequate levels, calcium and vitamin D do not reverse osteoporosis. They can't prevent it either, but a deficiency of either nutrient does put you at greater risk of developing the condition. Protein is also key to maintaining healthy bones. In one 2021 study of 7,000 care home residents, people who ate 3.5 servings of protein and calcium-rich dairy a day had 33% fewer fractures than those who ate only 2 servings a day. Number 5. Know your treatment options. If you're diagnosed with osteoporosis, there are a whole host of drugs available to help rebuild and strengthen your bones. The most widely used category are bisphosphonates, which can be taken as pills, daily, weekly, or monthly, injections, once every 3 months, or as intravenous infusions, annual. There are also options specifically for postmenopausal women. One example is Evista, that's E-V-I-S-T-A, a selective estrogen receptor modulator that reduces bone turnover and lowers your risk of developing breast cancer to boot. Although side effects like hot flashes might be unpleasantly reminiscent of menopause itself. What you're prescribed will depend on your specific circumstances, but the most important thing is to begin a treatment plan as soon as possible, particularly if you've broken a bone recently, since women who've had a fracture in the past year are at the highest risk for having another fracture imminently, and they need to be treated urgently, Tuft Sapri says. This is a condition that isn't going away and can contribute to lifespan, health span, and healthy aging. This is another article in Wellness. I followed a fitness influencer and it backfired. Yes, your body changes dramatically during perimenopause. Here's what not to do about it. This article is by Petra Guglielmetti. And that's spelled G-U-G-L-I-E-L-M-E-T-T-I. It started with a before and after bikini photo that Instagram suggested, interrupting my leisurely scroll through the usual shade gardens, botanical wallpapers, quinoa salads. I'm 46, but my feed would lead you to believe I'm 65, and I'm cool with that. I have zero desire to keep up with the Kardashians or J-Lo. All of this is to say, images of sculpted, bronzed, near-naked bodies don't often pop up on my phone, so I couldn't help clicking. This transformation coach looked a bit older than me, and her before-cut photo cut a standard-issue middle-aged finger, soft, pale, showing signs of gravity's gently relentless pull. Her after-photo, however, defied nature, so cut, so snatched, even in a teeny bikini. No wonder she was pushing 300K followers. Feeling subversive, I too hit follow. It felt off-brand for me, skeptical journalist that I am, but her photos appeared at a time when I was flailing for a motivational life raft. I'd drifted up 10-plus pounds and just couldn't lose them. I was going to bar class or running almost daily, getting 10,000 steps in, cutting junk, barely drinking alcohol, yet the idea of being able to wear certain jeans remained laughable. Could my problem be perimenopause? I'd had enough conversations with friends and listened to enough podcasts to know I was well into the age bracket. Apparently, even Instagram knew, serving me up this coach. I found myself lingering on her posts. The approach that helped her shed 50 pounds at age 50 seemed uncontroversial. No extreme diets, iffy supplements, or even intermittent fasting. In addition to carefully balancing and tracking her macros, fat, carbs, protein, she does two things I'd heard experts mention on perimenopause podcasts. Eats her weight in protein grams each day and trains with heavy weights, in her case, 5 days a week. This woman, her physique proving that, by harnessing the powers of deadlifts and air-fried sockeye salmon, one could wrench one's formerly toned physique from the wrinkled grip of time. Then I saw her posts suggesting easy ways to start. One was to count protein grams. Another was weight training at least 2 days a week. Pretty doable, right? First things first, my diet. Oh, how quickly protein math consumed me. Like many fit fluencers, this one starts each morning with at least 30 grams. My usual breakfast did not come close. The quarter cup of walnuts I'd added to my steel-cut oats had a thoroughly underwhelming 4.5 grams. The peanut butter I spread on whole grain bread, a lame 8 grams. Surely a hard-boiled egg would up the ante. But no, did you know an egg has just 6 grams of protein? Out went the toast and oats. In came foods I'd barely registered in the grocery aisles. Liquid egg whites and pre-made egg bites, meatless sausage patties, frozen protein waffles, protein bars and powders and shakes, jerky sticks, turkey bacon and pepperoni, mega protein yogurt. I grabbed the cooked shrimp tray on every Costco run and often ate an entire can of tuna, 29 grams, at lunch. I put pepitas on everything. When hunger hit during errands, I'd buy a pack of cheese sticks wrapped in salami, 25 greasy grams. My fridge contents were soon unrecognizable, which would surely translate into big change. But over the course of several months, my belly chub got smushier, my cellulite spread. On the scale, I saw digits I'd glimpsed just once before, right after the birth of my third child, I'd gained an additional 10 pounds. When I tell you even my baggy jammy pants were clingy, it now seems silly that this outcome was shocking. Having never progressed beyond the quick start phase, I'd been reaching for easy protein sources, many of them calorie dense and processed. Not only that, I'd let my protein fixation crowd out fruits and veggies, plus key fiber sources like my steel-cut oats. Oh, and while I ate fewer carbs during the day, I found myself inhaling them at dinner time. The kids still required their flour tortillas and basmati rice, or while watching TV late night. It's no mystery why, says Abby Smith Ryan, Ph.D., professor of exercise, physiology, and nutrition at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Vegetables and fruit provide vitamins, minerals, and water that help with metabolism and help keep us full, and the fiber sources you took out also help with feeling full. So this likely contributed to your hunger in the evening. Meanwhile, she noted that excess sodium likely had my perma bloated. That puffy effect is exacerbated when certain hormones are higher, usually in the luteal phase of your cycle, but during perimenopause that could be every other day. The real fix for puffy. That's where I went wrong on the calories inside of the equation. On the calories outside, I'd stopped running to make time for resistance training, and also because we keep hearing that walking is just as good for you. But once I went back to pounding the pavement and working up a real sweat, I quickly felt more svelte, and not just because it burns more fuel. Sweating is one of the best ways to regulate water retention, Smith Ryan notes. It also makes me feel happier and calmer all day, which leads to less stress eating of carbs. The thing is, when you look at this fitness influencer's whole Instagram grid, including her story highlights, her advice aligns with all of this. She recommends incorporating cardio and filling your plate with whole foods, including lots of fiber. I realized that that's the risk of getting health advice via social media. Even when it's legit, it arrives in bits and pieces, randomly served up via algorithm, so it's hard to keep sight of the big picture or course correct when you go astray. After a month of researching and resetting, I'm feeling a little slimmer and a lot wiser. I'm back to tons of fruits and veg, only now with a focus on including 30 grams of lean, complete protein at each meal, usually from whole foods. I've also learned that the protein plus weights equal muscle. Mantra isn't just another fitness trend. Research by Smith Ryan and others show that perimenopause is a critical window when the formula can prevent rapid muscle loss and fat accumulation. It's also a time when we need more protein because our bodies become less effective at using it. So my months as a protein junkie likely did me some good. You added a bunch of protein to your diet, which is really great. You're giving your body the building blocks it needs to maintain or build skeletal muscle, agrees Rochelle Pojednik. That's Pojednik, PhD, a researcher on nutrition and muscle physiology at Stanford and Harvard, and director of scientific research and education for Restore Hyper Wellness. Older and wiser. Another thing I've learned, that oft-cited benchmark of eating our weight in protein grams is based on data-ish. It's a generalization based on a range of protein intake that's been rigorously studied in athletes who are lifting weights, Progenic says, explaining that this seems to be the maximum amount of protein that muscles can synthesize in a day. Thus, it's a logical goal, but we needn't obsess. We can fall a little short and rest assured that our muscles are well fed. And finally, I've learned about two research-backed exercise approaches that really move the needle for middle-aged women. Pojednik recommends slow lifting of very heavy weights or explosive movements using body weight or light weights. Think jump squats and kettlebell swings. She recently posted this plan for all fitness levels on her Instagram. Both types of training build type 2 muscle fiber, the kind that significantly declines in women through perimenopause and beyond. My beloved bar class mostly builds type 1, or endurance muscle, which, shocker, women are already great at maintaining as we go, go, go through life. Also, to increase the ROI on my runs for this phase of life, Smith Ryan suggests intervals, 1 minute easy running, 1 minute hard. Repeat 10 times. I do a lot of research on high-intensity interval training, HIIT, and it's shown to be quite effective for women for health and body composition. She says, i.e., it helps reduce body fat, and one recent study showed it may help alleviate perimenopause symptoms. I'm planning to cobble all of this into a routine, but this go-round I'll focus on balance, consistency, and gradual improvement, not shortcuts and total transformation. What I always come back to is, control the controllables, says Pojednik. About the advice she gives women in midlife. We're the caretaker for our family, maybe starting to become a caretaker for elders, and we still have a career to focus on, all while our internal hormonal milieu is shifting. So sit back and say, what can I do in my life right now to take care of myself in the way I know I need to, without driving myself insane? Now that sounds like a plan. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We're stepping over into the relationships section. Being a stepmom is the best job I never wanted. How a troubled tween girl brought me to my knees and then stole my heart. By Leah Grudel, G-R-U-D-E-L. When I first met Bella, she looked like a beautiful fairy in her faded and creased flower tiara. For 2 years I'd been waiting to meet her. I felt like my relationship with her father, David, couldn't really begin until I saw him in the role of dad. He, of course, wanted to take it slow. He only agreed to this meeting because it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for his Broadway-loving child. I had snagged tickets to a rehearsal for the Emmy Awards. As we waited in line for the show, Bella, who was 10 at the time, clung to her dad's leg, half hiding behind him. I tried to engage her with talk of Hamilton, which I knew she loved, but all I got was an occasional weary glance, as if I were a monster she needed to keep an eye on. It didn't seem like ordinary shyness. The girl was terrified. I was 47 when I met David and had yet to have a real relationship. I'd never felt attractive, so I would contort myself into some version of the carefree, cool girl I thought every guy wanted. Like a cheap drugstore costume, the ill-fitting persona quickly fell apart, and with it, any chance of real connection. I didn't do any of this with David. From the start, his actions proved that he meant what he said and promised. At one point, I gained a lot of weight, as if to test him, knowing that not even love transcends fat. His did. I fell hard. I found it attractive that David had a daughter and was very much looking forward to building a relationship with her. Not a maternal one, mind you. She already has a mom. What I was picturing was more like the fun aunt, all giggles and hugs with very little responsibility. For the first few years, I planned every weekend we had with Bella down to the minute. Chinatown for dumplings, Blick to shop for crafts, the International Spy Museum, all packed into 1 or 2 days. David told me it was too much, but I wanted her to associate seeing me with having a blast. It didn't work. She was moody and would whisper to her dad while ignoring me, and the two of them would go off and do whatever bonding activity I had planned without me. I was failing, and I couldn't believe it. I started to feel sorry for myself for losing my alone time with David. Meanwhile, Bella was truly suffering. She was dealing with so much. The breakup of her parents, living in 2 different homes, me, and a brand new middle school. Over the next 2 years, she started acting out. It felt darker than your average teenage shenanigans. She was stealing, not just money from our wallets, but my credit cards and from stores. And the lies poured out of her with shocking ease. She told people she had a sister, that she was from Cuba, and that 2 girls in Brooklyn had mugged her. Most kids lie to get out of trouble, but she was creating different versions of herself. She started making up stories to pit one parent against the other. There were tales of some ugly exchanges with her mom, but the lies shrouded everything in uncertainty. We never knew what to believe. She also lied about me. After one of those early visits, she told David that I had pulled her aside and whispered, "I'm going to be your new mom." Something so wildly inappropriate had never crossed my mind. Besides, I had already decided I didn't want to be anyone's mother. This wasn't always the case. I had dreamed of motherhood for most of my life. When my 30s rolled in, I decided to do it alone. I went from scrolling through dating profiles to studying sperm donor profiles. For 2 months, I researched, planned, and attended single mothers by choice meetings. Then, one day, seemingly out of nowhere, my anxious brain gifted me one of the most freeing thoughts I'd ever had. You don't have to do this. Years of watching friends and my brother with their kids had woken me up to the all-encompassing reality of parenting. I finally admitted to myself that I didn't want the responsibility. It's a decision I have never regretted. Bella's behavior escalated. One night she didn't come home at all. We found her the next day, thankfully, but all those hours with the police sitting in our apartment gave our brains plenty of time to dream up horrifying scenarios. Even the cops didn't think it was going to end well. Worrying about her, reprimanding her, consoling her, fighting with her, consulting with her teachers, it took up all the space. David and Bella's mom constantly talked or argued about what to do. The new love bliss David and I had briefly enjoyed got shoved aside. Mostly everyone thought she'd grow out of it. She was still getting used to the changes, and middle school is notoriously wretched. I thought back to my own middle school years. My misery was directly related to the fact that I wasn't pretty. Bella is magnificent. My juvenile idea about beauty, namely that it is the key to happiness, is the only reason I can give, the only excuse I can make for not noticing what was really going on sooner. Depression recognizes depression, and finally I sensed it inside her. To people who have never dealt with depression, it looks a lot like something you should snap yourself out of with a bit of grit and will. Neither of Bella's parents had had experience with it, but I have. Here was the reason that taking her phone or pushing her into jiu-jitsu classes wasn't working. She needed therapy, and at this point, her parents were willing to give it a try. Bella describes her depression as a feeling that she doesn't belong here. When she says this, she's not talking about the city, this house, or any physical place. She means she should never have been born. It goes back to her relationship with her mother. As Bella has told me, if you hear that you are a mistake often enough, you start to believe it. To her, this is the truth, one that logically leads to thoughts of suicide, not just as a way out of pain, but because it seems like the right thing to do. Bella talks about suicide a lot. On multiple occasions, the talk has gotten so scary that David took her to the emergency room, though she was never admitted to the hospital. The lack of loving and validating relationship with her mother remains Bella's most significant source of pain, so much so that she is taking space from it. She is in mourning. Some days she's devastated. Others she seems unburdened, but the internalized damage is done. Bella, now 18, is often paralyzed with insecurity. But she moves forward, no longer contorting herself into someone she's not in order to win love or avoid affection. When I think about what she's had to overcome, I feel physical pain, like I can't fully exhale. Yet I marvel at her strength and will to thrive. While all is still not peaceful in our home, she can describe her feelings, recognize the why behind her actions, and calm herself down. In other words, she speaks fluent therapy like me. Bella is now my daughter, too. She got her looks from her mother, her ear for music and her talent for bad jokes from her dad. And for me, she's gotten a guide through the terrifying terrain of teendom, insecurity, and depression. Our bond may not be blood, but it is for life. I didn't ask for this. I didn't want it. And nothing in my life compares to how helpless raising her makes me feel. But when she comes in for a cuddle, confides in me, or uses a silly voice to make me laugh, I feel like a mom, proud, overflowing with love, and worried sick. This one is from the wellness section. Do I really want a divorce, or is it menopause? For a surprising number of couples, the two events are inextricable. Here, 14 women share their stories. This article is by Rosie Hopegood. Do you believe that menopause caused the breakdown of your marriage? When we teamed up with certified menopause practitioner and OBGYN Mary Claire Haver, MD, and posed this question to her patient list, hundreds of women shared stories of how menopause strained or even upended their marriages. Sometimes the beginning of the change marked the end of the relationship. Other times HRT therapy or functional medicine saved it. Some couples came out the other side stronger than before, and one woman's menopause journey culminated in her feeling as alive and vibrant as a teenager, who quite emphatically did not want to be married. According to a 2022 survey by the Family Law Menopause Project in the UK, 73% of women blamed menopause for their divorce. Haver says she can see why. The reasons are multifactorial. It may simply be that menopause gives you enough clarity to realize it's okay for me to go, I need to focus on me. Other times it's a mental health change that are not being addressed. In perimenopause, we see a surge of depression and anxiety, which can take a tremendous toll on relationships. I hear a lot about menopausal rage, too, when women are just yelling at their loved ones all the time, and they can't pull themselves out of it. The final piece of the jigsaw? Changes in libido that come with the transition, as well as physiological factors that can make sex downright painful. It's a huge problem. 95% of women have a loss of interest in sexual activity, Haver adds. There's definitely a hormonal issue there, because the hormones that tell our brains that sex is a good idea dramatically change during menopause. That leads a woman to be less likely to be interested in sex, even when she loves her partner. Board-certified psychiatrist and researcher Judith Joseph, M.D., agrees that the link between menopause and the breakdown of relationships is inextricable. While many people don't want to pathologize menopause, we need to be very realistic and not dismissive of what we're hearing, she says. It causes changes in the brain that impact mood, sleep, and thinking, and then all of these things impact your identity. With menopause, you're really challenged on both fronts. Emotionally, you may be more irritable or anxious, and then physically, it might be more challenging to connect with your partner. Haver, who is also the author of The New Menopause, recommends avoiding making major changes while still in the throes of symptoms. Something I say to my patients is, we need to get you back into you. We need to normalize what's going on with your hormones so we can get you back in a headspace to be making these huge decisions. Until you feel like you can function fully, it's probably not a good idea to make major life changes. Divorce may be the best thing for you, but let's get your mind back first. Let's get you sleeping at night and out of this fight or flight feeling. Does any of this resonate? You have tons of company. Here are 14 women's stories of how menopause impacted their marriage for better and for worse. I watched myself come unhinged. It hit hard and fast, just before Christmas and seemingly out of the blue. I was vicious, quick-tempered, irrational, and flat-out mean. I watched myself come unhinged. My steadfast husband of 15 years and my amazing 9-year-old daughter were the victims of my unrecognizable new self, someone I didn't know when I looked in the mirror. Thankfully, I caught myself before falling further into despair. Driving on the interstate, I happened to hear a radio interview with menopause-certified providers. I still remember feeling the weight lifted as I drove, finally realizing what was happening to me. I began my HRT journey and am finally feeling like myself again. My poor husband, though, he may never be the same after what I put him through. Nicola. After I had a hysterectomy due to uterine cancer at age 31, I went through menopause without realizing. Last summer, I turned 50 and had been in a funk for a few years. I thought I was too young for the change, but I knew something wasn't right. I wasn't my happy-go-lucky self and went off the rails with my entire immediate family. I cut almost everyone out and didn't know why. I just knew I wanted to be left alone. I took blood tests and got on HRT, and the relationship with my husband was repaired. I had no idea how important hormones are to happiness and well-being. I now follow everything hormone-related so I can thrive during the post-menopause years. Claire, 51. When I met my husband in high school, it was love at first sight. We've now been best friends and lovers for 45 years. But 14 years ago, when I was 46, I started to feel changed physically and mentally in a way I couldn't explain or identify. For the first time, I felt threatened that my husband would leave me for another woman. I was very hurt when he told me that he'd understood why so many marriages break up in the couple's 50s when women stop wanting sex. He began to shut down and seemed to care less about me. Later, I found out he thought I was repulsed by him. He felt angry and resentful because neither of us knew the reasons why I was feeling like that. I know now that I was experiencing symptoms of perimenopause, but doctors at the same time gaslit me. It's the same story that I'm just now beginning to read and hear about. My husband just turned 60, and now that he's beginning to show signs of lower testosterone, I think he's more understanding of the fact that it wasn't my fault. Martina, 60. To begin with, I had no idea what perimenopause was. I didn't realize my lack of interest in sex and my tiredness were linked to hormones. I ran away from sex, and my then-spouse resented me for that, and slept in the guest room. Around that time, I came across a book on HRT at my chiropractor's office. I was shocked at what I was reading and couldn't believe I could finally get help for what I had been going through. I found a hormone doctor and started HRT, but it came a little too late to save my marriage. I was ready for sex, but my husband was done with our marriage and moved out. We got a divorce after 34 years of marriage. Of course, there were many issues, but sex was the biggest one. Angela. When my journey started at 40, my doctors didn't think I needed HRT because my hormone levels were normal. The biggest side effect was loss of libido and irritability, which continued for 6 years. By the time I found a doctor to take me seriously, my husband and I were living like roommates. I called a stop to having painful intercourse, and within 2 years, my then-husband lost interest in me. He left the marriage without warning, saying lack of intimacy was the reason. 6 weeks later, he had a girlfriend, Vicky. Menopause has turned everything upside down. We've been married for 26 years, during which time we lived in 3 different continents and had 19 house moves. So we're no strangers to change. We're used to pivoting. But menopause has brought on big structural changes in my personality and, as a consequence, in our marriage. Not only is desire absent on my mind, but the idea of remaining together has completely gone out the door. My take on life and a future together has changed radically. I thought it was depression at first, but now I realize that menopause has caused me to completely shift my perspective. Although my husband has been understanding of what I've been experiencing, it doesn't seem to be enough. I'm just not the same person anymore. Eileen, 51. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We're moving over to culture and news. Adele confirmed her engagement to Rich Paul in the best possible way. The two have been dating since 2021. This article is by Chelsea Sanchez. It's official. Adele and Rich Paul are getting married. The Grammy winner confirmed the news during a sweet fan interaction at a concert in Munich. In clips shared to social media, Adele reads a sign held up by a fan. "Will you marry me?" "I can't marry you because I'm already getting married," she says, holding up her ring finger. "So I can't, but I appreciate it." Adele was first romantically linked to the NBA agent in early 2021, following their initial meeting on a dance floor at a mutual friend's birthday party, she told Rolling Stone in 2021. "Rich and I have always known everything about each other since the day we got together," the singer said in a 2023 interview with The Hollywood Reporter. Since they started dating, Adele has shared tidbits of their love life with fans. "She's not as concerned about being private with her life because she's very happy with Rich," an insider explained to E! In 2021. "She's enjoying learning about the sports world and meeting many of Rich's friends. She's going with it and is very happy." Adele was previously married to Simon Konecki, the CEO of charity Drop for Drop, from 2011 to 2019. She opened up about the end of their relationship while promoting her 2021 album, 30. "It made me really sad," she said at the time. "Then having so many people that I don't know that I didn't make that work. I was embarrassed. No one made me feel embarrassed. But you feel like you didn't do a good job." Still in culture and news, everything to know about the Democratic National Convention. Kamala Harris and Tim Walz will make a case for their ticket ahead of Election Day, by Rosa Sanchez. The Democratic National Convention is nearly here, and the entire country is preparing to see the turnout from the Dem nominees, presidential candidate Kamala Harris and vice presidential candidate Tim Walz. Here is everything you need to know about the multi-day event. When is the Democratic National Convention? The convention will run from Monday, August 19 through Thursday, August 22. Election Day is just 75 days later on November 5th. Where is the DNC? It will be held in Chicago at two separate venues. The United Center, located on the city's west side, will host evening events, including speeches meant to be live-streamed and watched by the public. McCormick Place, near Lake Michigan, will host more private, closed-meeting daytime events. Who will be there? Now, of course, we'll get plenty of speeches and appearances from Kamala Harris and her running mate, Tim Walz. President Joe Biden, who stepped away from the race this July, is expected to speak as well. And we'll surely hear speeches from other politicians within the party, as well as regular voters who support the Harris-Walz ticket. A full list of speakers will likely be released closer to the start of the convention. What is the purpose of the convention? At prior DNCs, the party held a roll call vote to officially choose its nominees. But that will not happen this time. Harris was already confirmed earlier in August through a virtual roll call. So the point of the convention this year will be for the candidates to pour their hearts out about their policies, appeal to their supporters and voters, and make a case for the Harris-Walz ticket, explaining what their tenure in the White House would entail. Here's a gift idea for a mom. Spa-like luxury Nola Silky Piped Robe. With a feel as smooth as silk but machine washable, mom can have spa-like luxury every day with this robe. Featuring a whimsical botanical print, this robe is perfect for post-bath lounging or as a getting-ready gown before a night out. And the robe itself is an off-cream color with some blue, pale blue, and pink flowers with green leaves. And it's $99 at Pottery Barn. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.